You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
England is probably not one of the first countries that comes to mind in a discussion of anti-Semitism, but even after Jews were expelled there in the 13th century, they continued to be depicted in a negative light in English literature and plays. Today, academics organize boycotts against the participation of Israelis in international forums, and people like David Irving deny that the Holocaust occurred, leading in his case to the Irving versus Lipstadt trial in the late 1990s. Anthony Julius is a prominent British lawyer and academic who served as an attorney in that case. He's written a new book called Trials of the Diaspora, A History of Anti-Semitism in England. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased that he's come by to talk about it with us. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is your second book on anti-Semitism, and it's over 800 pages long. Did the first book get you thinking about this?
the first book.
Well, I mean, are we going to see a third?
No. You're not going to see a third. For a long time, I thought no one was going to see the second either. I think studying anti-Semitism is a curious recreation. To spend so much time with something one despises is not usual.
Well, your first book focused on T.S. Eliot and the accusations of his anti-Semitism. Now, he's an American-born, and so was his contemporary Ezra Pound. So why British anti-Semitism?
Well, as you said in your introduction, I was the lawyer representing Deborah Lipstadt in her case with David Irving. And the first day of the trial, I walked down with a friend to court, and he said to me, "You have to write a book about this." And my immediate reaction was, no, I'd spent enough time in Irving's company. I certainly wasn't going to have him sitting on my shoulder in my study for another 2 years after the case was over. And then my friend said, "Well, in that case, write something about English anti-Semitism." As you said, I mean, Eliot was essentially an American. I hadn't really addressed the phenomenon of English anti-Semitism. And I felt that I had some things to say about it.
Well, to some degree, that was also a zeitgeist thing, wasn't it? I mean, he was part of a whole group that, and especially in the upper classes, not just in Britain, but as we see in films like Rules of the Game and in France, mm-hmm. there was always a bit of snobbery about Jews in the upper classes of Europe.
Mm. I mean, two things about that. First of all, it's perfectly true, of course, it was part of the zeitgeist, but that didn't mean that there weren't choices being exercised. There were plenty of people who were not anti-Semites, even though the prevailing ambience was perhaps hostile to Jews. The second thing is probably worth saying is that in Eliot's case, at any rate, he didn't just reflect the anti-Semitism of his times, but he contributed to it.
Anti-Semitism in English literature started long before T.S. Eliot, and ironically, it emerged during the 400 years when Jews were prohibited from living in England. So had authors like Marlowe and Shakespeare even met a Jew?
No, it's overwhelmingly likely that they hadn't.
And there were a few who had escaped from Spain.
There were a few crypto-Christians, Muranos, who passed through, but they were schooled in the arts of concealing their religion. It's unlikely that they would have identified themselves as Jews to Shakespeare or to Marlowe. Really, what this phenomenon demonstrates is that anti-Semitism is unrelated to the activity or even the presence of actual Jews.
Why had Jews been expelled in 1290?
The Jews arrived in England at the towards the end of the 11th century after the invaders from France, the Norman conquest, had established themselves in the country as rulers. And for a few decades, the Jews were perfectly content, led entirely peaceable, prosperous lives. Then they became the object of a rather sinister and predatory attention from the king, who saw them as an opportunity to enrich himself. Things rather deteriorated from there. By the time 1290 came, some 150 years later, the Jews were an impoverished rump and without cash and therefore easily expelled.
Well, there was also the fever, the fervor over the Crusades.
Yes.
And didn't the Magna Carta reflect a growing unpopularity of Jewish money lending activities?
The Jews took the full force of the antagonism towards emerging financial practices. It's true.
There are two clauses in the Magna Carta that state that if a debtor dies before his debt is paid, neither his heir nor his widow will be responsible for repaying the debt, which was aimed directly at Jews. The Jews were also required to wear badges that identified them as Jews, and then they were expelled.
Yes.
But after they were expelled, that's when all the blood libel rumors gained currency. You don't know about that?
No, I do know about it. I'm only hesitating because the first blood libel actually was in 1144 during the currency of the first settlement of Jews. The blood libel entered literature after the Jews had been expelled, but the Jewish communities in England were endlessly plagued by allegations that they had abducted and killed Christian children.
And was there a strain of anti-Semitic literature throughout all of these 400 years?
Yes, I mean from within 30, 40 years of the expulsion, there was a ballad circulating, an anonymous ballad, which called Sir Hugh, which was about a little boy who had been kidnapped by a young woman, the daughter of a Jew, and tortured and killed. That story was taken up by Chaucer, one of the great English writers, one of our canonic writers, and incorporated in the Canterbury Tales. And from there, stories of predatory Jews trapping Gentiles became commonplace.
Now, shouldn't I be a bit surprised because of the anti-Semitism during the Elizabethan era? Because the big religious clash there was between Catholics and Protestants.
Yes, yes, it's true. And one of the great advantages for the Jews in England over the last 400 years, at any rate, is that they've been outsiders to that conflict. And in fact, beneficiaries of its resolution, because the conflict ended with an acknowledgement of the need for religious tolerance, and Jews benefited from that.
Why were they readmitted in 1655?
Well, there was a feeling, both commercial and religious, that it made sense for Jews to be allowed back in. Commercial, because Oliver Cromwell, who was running Britain at that time, had a sense that England lacked a certain competitiveness with other powers, such as Holland, and that the Jews would assist with a more sophisticated financial understanding of the way in which the world worked. But religious also, because there was a strong conviction that unless and until Jews occupied every country in the world, messianic times would not arrive.
My guest is Anthony Gillias, whose latest book is Trials of the Diaspora, A History of Anti-Semitism in England. Okay, Jews come back. Does that mean that anti-Semitism flares up again?
No, what it means, I think, is that a different kind of anti-Semitism emerges, radically different, actually, to the kind that prevailed during the first settlement, the medieval settlement. It's a much calmer, more contained anti-Semitism, much more an affair of snobbery and exclusion, condescension, contempt.
Is it particularly British, or is this the sort of thing that we see throughout Europe?
I think it, so to speak, caught on elsewhere in Europe, but I think it originated in Britain. So much of English anti-Semitism is innovative in that way.
Well, but Britain, unlike the United States, has had a Jewish prime minister. In fact, Disraeli, although he was converted to Christianity, Disraeli is one of the most fondly remembered prime ministers in British history, and it's always pointed out that he was Jewish.
Yes, yes, of course, that's right. He was in fact a member of Parliament a long time before Jews were allowed, as Jews, to serve in Parliament. English anti-Semitism is an interesting thing because it has not had the suffocating, certainly not lethal effect on Jews that the anti-Semitism of many other countries have had.
So it's something that is discussed, but isn't necessarily imposed. Well, at least not until, although there were laws, as you said, that excluded Jews from Parliament. I don't know whether there were similar laws in France or in Germany or the German states at the time.
If one's trying to understand English anti-Semitism, certainly the anti-Semitism of the last 200 or 300 years, you can't look to laws. You have to look to social practices, snobbery, sentiments of mistrust, a kind of wariness of Jews. That's where you find it.
Where does someone like Sir Oswald Mosley fit into all of this? He was a member of the Labour Party who then became enamored of Mussolini and actually had his second wedding performed by Adolf Hitler. Was it Adolf Hitler or one of the top Nazi officials?
He was a huge fan of Hitler, and the thing about Mosley, I think, is that he was this rather anomalous and unusual figure in English history. He was a Nazi at a time when Britain was preparing for war with Nazi Germany. There's not much one can read off from his behavior about anti-Semitism in England in general.
What about somebody like David Irving? He is a Holocaust denier, but there are Holocaust deniers in this country, in Canada, I guess, all over the world. Are there more in England?
Holocaust denial is very much a fringe phenomenon in England, even more so now than 10, 15 years ago. It has greater salience in France and the west coast of the United States than England.
Well, how much do you think the kind of subtle anti-Semitism we do find in England comes out of the imperial history of England, especially what happened in Palestine?
Well, it's a very interesting question you ask, because Britain's imperial history actually, I think, was responsible for inhibiting the development of anti-Semitism as much as anything else. At the end of the 19th century, a really, really dangerous kind of anti-Semitism emerged, and it had as its principal article of faith that the Jews were a collective conspiracy seeking to take over the world for their own ends. You see a bit of that even now in talk about the Jewish lobby, the Israel lobby, and so on.
But also the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Of the Elders of Zion was an invention of Tsarist agents, and what the document said was that the Jews were exactly seeking to conspire to take over the world. Now, interestingly, that very, very dangerous form of anti-Semitism never really took root in Britain, because the British knew exactly who was running the world. They were.
Well, how does the phrase anti-Semitism even come into the language?
Anti-Semitism was a term invented by a German Jew hater called Wilhelm Marr in the 1870s. He was embarrassed that in a period of ideologies when one was either a socialist or a liberal or a conservative, Jew haters didn't have the dignity of an ideology. So he suggested that they should call themselves anti-Semites to give a kind of pseudo-scientific racist basis for their hatred.
Didn't Thomas Mann say that anti-Semitism was the socialism of fools because of the way it was used as a populist political tool in Germany?
The phrase "the socialism of fools" was a very telling one, because what it identified was an anti-Semitism on the left, which is a phenomenon that's often misunderstood.
Now, whenever anti-Semitism comes up, I'm almost guaranteed to get an email message or a comment on our show page from listeners pointing out that Arabs are also Semites, and so the phrase is really a misnomer.
Yes, I mean, that itself is a misunderstanding. As I say, anti-Semitism was invented by a Jew hater. Until then, it was just called Jew hatred. If we understand the term as referring to Jew hatred, which is the proper sense of it, then I think we don't get into that confusion.
You don't like the term, and yet you use it.
Well, one has to speak the language that's spoken. This is how Jew hatred is now referred to, and it would be artificial to dissent from that.
My guest is Anthony Julius, who is the author of several books, including T.S. Eliot, Anti-Semitism in Literary Form. He is also the deputy chairman of the commercial law firm Mishkon de Rea, which specializes in litigation law, chairman of the London Consortium, a visiting professor at Birkbeck College, University of London. And his latest book is Trials of the Diaspora, A History of Antisemitism in England. It's published by Oxford University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Anthony Julius, his latest book, Trials of the Diaspora, A History of Antisemitism in England. It's published by Oxford University Press. Was antisemitism different before there was a Jewish state? I'm talking about in England.
Antisemitism exists in various versions, and certainly an antisemitism associated with a hostile attitude towards Israel, of course, came into existence when Israel came into existence.
Can you be critical of Israeli policies and not be anti-Semitic in your mind?
Of course. Towards the end of my book, I asked that question, and I observed that mostly it's answered in a brisk way, yes, of course one can, but then no criticisms are offered. What I try to do is I try to identify criticisms that can be made, I write two or three pages about criticisms that can be made of the administration of West Bank and until the evacuation of Gaza. And then I conclude by saying all of these criticisms are true, it seems to me, and therefore they cannot be anti-Semitic because what is true is not anti-Semitic. So I have no difficulty with that proposition at all.
But there are people who bridle at any criticism of Israel, just like there are people who bridle at any defense of Israel.
Yes.
And I've had that experience on the show both ways. I'm afraid to say that I think Avigdor Lieberman is somebody who maybe engaged in something the equivalent of racism because I know I'm going to get angry mail. So I didn't say that.
Right.
What about Zionism? Do you think that denial of the ideas of Zionism is anti-Semitic?
Well, I think it depends what you mean. If you think that, if you're the kind of person who thinks that the Jewish state should dissolve itself, that the Jews, particularly the Israeli Jews, the Jews who hold Israeli passports, do not have a right to a state of their own, and you think that, particularly of Israel and of no other country in the world, then I think you have a hard task in explaining why you pick out the Jews for that particular form of political punishment.
Although there are Hasidic groups, aren't there, that interpret the Bible in a way says that Israel cannot be a Jewish state until the Messiah comes.
Yes, there are. And some of these groups make common cause with Israel's enemies. And they do no service to the Jewish people.
What do you think is misunderstood about Zionism in the mainstream?
I'm not sure how misunderstood it is. Zionism is simply a word which now describes the national identity of Israelis. And I suppose its most obvious analogy would be Americanism or Englishism.
Do you think that people who would not identify themselves as anti-Semitic but think that extreme Zionism has led to what can be seen as racist policies are misunderstanding something?
I don't know what extreme Zionism means. I mean, if you look
somebody like Avigdor Lieberman, who pretty much talks about expelling all Arabs from Israel.
I've not heard him call for the expulsion of Arabs from Israel, but in any event, the point I was going to make was that if you look at a founding document of Zionism, like Herzl's The Jewish State, it's perfectly clear that he anticipates a state in which there will be equal rights for Jews and non-Jews. He also anticipates a separation of church and state, and what he has in mind is essentially a liberal democracy in which Jews can be secure.
But that's not what happened.
Well, it's much closer to what happens than the kind of fantasies of Israel peddled by many anti-Zionists.
But Israel does really have a two-tier system in which its Muslims are denied certain rights, put into lousier areas, can't stay in certain parts of Jerusalem. Even its own citizens, they can't serve in the military.
Of that's completely untrue. I don't think there's a single statement you've made which is true.
Okay. Well, then
Arab Israelis can serve in the army, but they're not compelled to serve. The reason they're not compelled to serve was a sensitivity on the part of the Jewish state that they should not be required to serve in arms against family members from other states. There are some Arab communities that that asked to be compelled to serve, the Druze Arab community in particular. That's the take, just one point that you made in the number that you made.
But there are all sorts of religious laws that have been enacted, and people have suggested that Israel has strayed from the original ideal of Zionism.
Well, I don't think that's true either. The religious laws that apply are personal laws. And
I mean, people aren't denied the right to go into certain neighborhoods or drive cars, or there aren't laws about getting divorces and things.
This is the point about personal laws is that Israel is a state in which laws of personal status are confessional. So the Christian community is governed by its laws, the Jewish community is governed by its laws, the Muslim community is governed by its laws. There is too small a space, I think, for a secular law of personal status in Israel, and that's the subject of hot subjects of political debate. But that's got nothing to do with Zionism, because in that respect, Christians, Muslims, and Jews are all equal. Each is oppressed or not, depending on one's view, by the laws of their own religion.
My guest is Anthony Julius, who's written a book called Trials of the Diaspora, History of Anti-Semitism in England. It's published by Oxford University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the criticism of the Israel lobby. Now, there are actually two Israel lobbies in the United States now, one that APEC that pretty much supports whatever the Israeli government does, and then there's one that's that says, well, we shouldn't be supporting everything that Israel does. Do you see criticism of APEC as anti-Semitic?
It doesn't have to be, but if criticism of APEC essentially comes to the claim that Jews are conspiring to advance their own interests to the detriment of the state in which they live, then that overstatement is inescapably anti-Semitic.
Now, in this country, we have not had academics try to bar Israelis from participating in conferences and forums. But we have seen those calls in Europe and in England. Do you see that as an example of some kind of anti-Semitism?
Jews have been the subject of boycott calls for at least 1,000 years. It was the practice of the Christian Church in the Middle Ages to call on the faithful to have nothing to do with Jews. It was the practice of Hitler's Germany in the 30s. It was the practice of the Arab League and of Arab agitators pretty much throughout the history of the Jewish settlement in Palestine. The calls for boycotts now require Jews, Israeli Jews, to exclude themselves from the academic community simply on the grounds that they are Jews. That seems to me inescapably anti-Semitic.
Seems to me like that would be illegal. So how does it play out?
Well, it is not illegal
to exclude
in
Jews.
Principle, in England, for example, there are laws which make it very difficult, and so the boycotters have a slightly difficult time squaring what they want to do with race discrimination laws, for example. But anti-Semitism has its own inventiveness.
Well, you've said that anti-Semitism in England is denser than it is in other countries. What do you mean by that?
What I had in mind, really, was the was the quality of innovativeness in English anti-Semitism. Essentially, what originated in England tended then to be exported abroad. So, for example, England was the first country to expel Jews. England was the first country in which the blood libel appeared. The non-lethal anti-Semitism that I was describing a little earlier in your show, that originated in England. And, of course, Britain was responsible for administering the mandate in Palestine for 20-odd years before the state was established.
And because of the tensions there, and the fact that British soldiers died. Do you think that that has led to some of the feelings? I when I lived in England, I remember people being angry with Greeks because British soldiers had died in Cyprus. It seemed to me that they were missing the point, but there was quite a bit of anti-British activity during the years leading up to Israeli independence.
Certainly the 2 years before independence, there was a lot of very ugly fighting between the Yishuv, the Jewish settlement in Palestine, and British forces. And that led to a lot of bad feeling directed at Jews. And of course, where it tipped over into anti-Semitism was the little amount of rioting there was in some English cities against Jews who had nothing to do with what was going on in Palestine, started to create feelings of unease. But those passed quite quickly, and you don't hear talk of that nowadays. It was a very local and specific phenomenon.
Do you think that one of the reasons that there are a couple of reasons that people might give for anti-Semitism being the way it is in England. One of them is that England still is very much of a class-conscious country, and Jews were often seen as nouveau riche, as arriviste, and that goes all the way back to the Rothschilds, despite their important role in saving Britain during the Napoleonic Wars, but also the fact that there aren't a heck of a lot of Jews in England.
I mean, I think the class point is well made, and there are about 200, 250,000 Jews in England now.
Well, that is
a population of in a population of about 60 million. But anti-Semitism has very little to do with the presence of actual Jews, as we talked about before. So I think it's neutral.
Has it been something that you've had to deal with in your own life?
Not really. Although when I was I acted for the Princess of Wales in her divorce, and when the case was settled, there was a very odd newspaper report commenting on the settlement, which observed that, of course, I would have got a good settlement because I was a Jewish intellectual and the son of a retailer, and I couldn't be expected to understand the rules of fair play. That was a.
And what newspaper was that?
That was the Daily Telegraph. Hmm. That was a pretty strong example of English anti-Semitism.
Maybe I've gotten it wrong because I read Ulysses a long time ago, but I seem to remember the headmaster saying to Daedalus, you know why there was never anti-Semitism in England? It's because they never let them in. You're saying the exact opposite is true.
He says it in relation to the Jews of Ireland. Yeah. He says the reason there was no anti-Semitism in Ireland is because
in England.
He's clear about anti-Semitism in England. I think that the problem about anti-Semitism in England is that it established itself as a tradition a long time before Jews were around, and it just carried on.
And do you see any changes in the future, or is as long as there are tensions between Israel and its neighbors, many of which had strong connections to Great Britain, do you think there will continue to be problems?
Well, I don't think anti-Semitism is a function or a spillover of the difficulties in the Middle East, although those difficulties can give heart to anti-Semites and encourage them to become more vocal in their attacks on Jews. I fear that anti-Semites will find other reasons and excuses to be hostile to Jews.
Anthony Julius's book is called Trials of the Diaspora, History of Anti-Semitism in England, called An Essential History by Philip Roth. It is published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.